A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about the clinical tangle that happens when ADHD and depression show up together, which they do, constantly. The core question is how a clinician pulls apart whether you're looking at primary ADHD with depression layered on top, depression that's just mimicking ADHD through impaired concentration, or both conditions firing independently. And then the practical fork in the road. Are there signs that help differentiate? And can treating the ADHD well enough make the depression unnecessary to treat directly? This is the kind of question that makes psychiatric diagnosis feel less like a blood test and more like detective work, where half the witnesses are lying.
It really is. And the numbers alone tell you why this matters. The comorbidity rate between ADHD and major depressive disorder sits somewhere around 30-40%, depending on which study you're reading. So, if you're a clinician seeing adult ADHD patients, you're basically flipping a coin on whether depression is also in the room. It's not some edge case.
30-40% is one of those statistics that should probably be printed on the door of every psychiatry practice, right next to the HIPAA notice.
Here's the thing that makes it messier than the raw number suggests. Depression itself produces executive dysfunction, impaired concentration, indecisiveness, fatigue, psychomotor slowing. Those are literally in the DSM criteria for a major depressive episode. But they're also core ADHD symptoms. So you've got two different conditions that can produce nearly identical complaints, and the patient is sitting there saying, "I can't focus, I can't get anything done, my mind is either racing or completely blank. Which one is it?"
The diagnostic equivalent of two different diseases that both give you a fever and a cough.
And just like in that scenario, the treatment path you choose depends entirely on which one is actually driving the bus. If you throw stimulants at someone whose concentration problems are purely depression-mediated, you might get a transient boost followed by nothing useful. If you throw an SSRI at someone whose depression is entirely secondary to untreated ADHD wrecking their life, you might see partial improvement, but you're not touching the root cause.
Walk me through how a decent clinician actually pulls this apart. Because I imagine the patient's own self-report is not necessarily reliable here. If I've been unable to focus for 10 years, and I'm also miserable about it, I might not know which came first or which is causing which.
Right. And that's actually where the diagnostic process starts. The first cut most clinicians make is temporal. They're looking for the developmental history. ADHD is, by definition, a neurodevelopmental disorder. The symptoms have to be present before age 12. So the first question isn't, "Are you depressed right now?" It's, "What were you like as a kid?"
Which immediately creates a problem. Because how many adults have reliable third-party accounts of their own childhood behavior?
It's a huge problem. Ideally, you'd have school reports, parent interviews, something objective. In practice, you're often working with the patient's memory, which is itself filtered through whatever mood state they're currently in. A depressed patient might retrospectively paint their entire childhood as dysfunctional. Someone with lifelong ADHD might not even realize their childhood was atypical because they had no frame of reference. They just thought everyone struggled that much.
I thought everyone lost their homework 4 times a week and got yelled at for staring out the window.
And that's a phrase you hear constantly in adult ADHD assessments. So the temporal approach helps, but it's not foolproof. The next thing clinicians look at is the quality of the attention complaint. In depression, the concentration deficit tends to be more global. Everything is foggy. The patient describes their thinking as slowed, heavy, effortful. There's a qualitative heaviness to it.
Versus ADHD, where it's more
selective and inconsistent. The ADHD patient can hyperfocus for 8 hours on something they find engaging, then be completely unable to sustain attention on something boring for 30 seconds. The depression patient usually can't hyperfocus on anything. The impairment is more uniform. That inconsistency is a pretty strong signal that you're looking at ADHD rather than depression mimicking. ADHD.
That distinction feels useful, but also precarious, Because a severely depressed person might also say they can scroll social media for hours but can't read a book. Is that hyperfocus or just passive consumption?
That's a fair pushback, and good clinicians will probe for exactly that distinction. Hyperfocus in ADHD tends to be active engagement, sometimes to the point of losing track of time, forgetting to eat, being unable to disengage even when you want to. The depressed person doom-scrolling is often describing something more passive, more dissociative. They're not locked in because they're fascinated. They're locked in because they can't muster the executive function to stop.
It's the difference between being absorbed and being stuck.
That's a really nice way to put it. Absorbed versus stuck. I might steal that.
You're welcome to it. So we've got developmental history and we've got the quality of the attention complaint.
The third thing is the mood architecture. In primary depression, the mood disturbance tends to have a more autonomous quality. You wake up feeling terrible regardless of what's happening. There might be diurnal variation, classically worse in the morning, but the mood is the driver. In ADHD, the mood disturbance is often reactive and tied to executive failure. You feel awful because you missed a deadline, because you forgot an appointment, because you let someone down again. The dysphoria is secondary to the functional impairment.
One is mood causing dysfunction. The other is dysfunction causing mood.
And in clinical practice, patients with ADHD-driven depression will often describe feeling genuinely fine when things are going well, when their systems are working, when they're not in a pile of accumulated failures. The depression lifts when the chaos lifts. That's much less characteristic of a primary major depressive episode, which tends to have its own internal rhythm that's less responsive to external circumstances.
Which would also explain why treating the ADHD sometimes makes the depression evaporate without any direct intervention on the mood side, which was part of the original question.
Yes, and this is well documented clinically. There are patients, particularly those whose depression is clearly secondary to the life consequences of untreated ADHD. Academic failure, occupational struggles, relationship breakdowns, chronic underachievement, where effective ADHD treatment produces a significant improvement in mood without any antidepressant. I've seen cases where someone starts appropriate stimulant therapy and within weeks they're describing their mood as transformed, not because stimulants are antidepressants, but because they're suddenly able to function, and functioning feels good.
That's the clean case. What about when both are primary? When someone has ADHD and also has a major depressive disorder that would exist even if their ADHD were perfectly treated.
That's the harder scenario, and it's also extremely common. The genetic studies suggest there's some shared heritability between ADHD and depression. They're not entirely independent. So you get people who have both conditions running in parallel, each exacerbating the other. In those cases, treating only the ADHD leaves a residual depression that's real and impairing. Treating only the depression leaves executive dysfunction that makes it hard to implement any of the behavioral activation or cognitive strategies that depression treatment depends on.
You're stuck in a loop where the ADHD undermines the depression treatment and the depression undermines the ADHD treatment.
That's exactly the clinical challenge. And the consensus approach tends to be to treat whichever condition is more severe or more impairing first, but with the recognition that you'll probably need to address both. The clinical guidelines from groups like CADRA, the Canadian ADHD Resource Alliance, explicitly recommend assessing for and treating comorbid conditions alongside ADHD, rather than assuming one will resolve the other.
That's a new one for me.
They're one of the more practically useful organizations in this space. Their guidelines are refreshingly direct about the fact that comorbidity is the rule, not the exception. They estimate that up to 80% of adults with ADHD have at least one comorbid psychiatric condition: depression, anxiety, substance use. It's almost more unusual to see a pure, uncomplicated adult ADHD case than a complicated one.
80% is one of those numbers that makes you wonder if the diagnostic categories are even describing distinct things, or if we're just carving nature at joints that don't actually exist.
That's the perennial debate in psychiatry. The DSM gives you these neat categorical boxes, but the underlying biology is dimensional and overlapping. The same neural circuits involved in attention and executive function are involved in mood regulation: the prefrontal cortex, the anterior cingulate, the basal ganglia. Dopamine and norepinephrine systems are dysregulated in both conditions. So, the idea that these are completely separate diseases is probably wrong at a neurobiological level. They're more like different expressions of overlapping system dysfunction.
Which brings us to the third scenario from the prompt. Depression that looks like ADHD, where the attention symptoms are entirely mood-driven, and there's no underlying ADHD at all. How do you catch that one?
This is where the developmental history becomes absolutely crucial. If someone presents at age 35 with concentration problems that started at age 33 when they became depressed, and they have no childhood history of attention difficulties, no academic struggles, no pattern of disorganization or impulsivity predating the depression, you're probably looking at depression mimicking. ADHD. The attention symptoms are a feature of the depression, not a separate disorder.
What if the depression started at 33, and the person also happened to have undiagnosed ADHD their whole life? They might not recognize the childhood symptoms as symptoms.
Right, and that's the false negative problem. The false positive problem is arguably more concerning from a treatment perspective. You don't want to put someone on stimulants unnecessarily. But the false negative problem, missing the ADHD because you attribute everything to depression, means you might treat the depression incompletely for years without addressing a major contributing factor.
You're damned if you do, and damned if you don't, which seems to be the unofficial motto of psychiatry.
The clinical art is in holding both possibilities open and using treatment response as diagnostic information. If you treat the depression adequately and the concentration symptoms persist despite mood improvement, that's a strong signal that there's an independent attention disorder. Conversely, if you treat the ADHD and the mood doesn't improve, that suggests a primary depression that needs its own intervention.
Treatment as diagnostic probe. That's elegant but slow.
It can be agonizingly slow. We're talking weeks to months for an adequate antidepressant trial, and that's assuming the patient tolerates the medication and the dose is right. There's been some interest in more rapid indicators. Neuropsychological testing, for example, can sometimes help differentiate. Tests of sustained attention like the Continuous Performance Test, or CPT, tend to show different patterns in ADHD versus depression. ADHD patients typically show more variability, more commission errors, more impulsivity. Depressed patients show more omission errors, more slowing, more inconsistent but not impulsive responding.
Commission versus omission. Doing things you shouldn't versus not doing things you should.
That's the broad pattern, though it's not diagnostically definitive on its own. The CPT has reasonable sensitivity but mediocre specificity. Plenty of things can cause attentional impairment on a computer test, including just being sleep-deprived or anxious about being tested.
Speaking of sleep, where does that fit into this differential? Because poor sleep impairs attention and also tracks with both depression and ADHD.
Sleep is the great confounder here. ADHD is strongly associated with circadian rhythm disruptions, delayed sleep phase syndrome in particular. Depression also messes with sleep architecture, though more classically with early morning awakening and fragmented sleep. So you've got overlapping sleep pathology that can independently cause concentration problems. A good clinician is going to ask about sleep in detail before concluding anything about attention. Sometimes what looks like ADHD plus depression is actually just chronic sleep deprivation plus the mood consequences of chronic sleep deprivation.
Which would make the intervention a sleep study rather than a stimulant or an SSRI.
Though getting a sleep study covered and scheduled is its own adventure, but the principle stands. The differential diagnosis for inattention includes sleep disorders, thyroid dysfunction, anemia, chronic pain, substance use, and about a dozen other things that aren't psychiatric at all. The good clinician is ruling out medical causes while simultaneously trying to disentangle the psychiatric ones.
The average clinician this prompt asks about, what does their process actually look like in a typical 15-minute medication management appointment? Because everything you've described sounds like it takes hours.
This is the uncomfortable reality. The average clinician, particularly in a high-volume practice, does not have time to do this properly. The diagnostic interview for adult ADHD, done well, takes at least an hour, often two. Most psychiatric follow-ups are scheduled for 15 to 20 minutes. So what happens in practice is that many clinicians default to treating the most obvious presenting complaint, which is often depression, and the ADHD goes unrecognized. Or they see the ADHD, prescribe a stimulant, and miss the depression because the patient didn't spontaneously mention anhedonia or hopelessness when they were focused on describing their concentration problems.
The system is structurally biased toward incomplete diagnosis.
And this is especially true for certain populations. Women, for example, are more likely to have their ADHD missed and their symptoms attributed to depression or anxiety. The inattentive subtype of ADHD, which is more common in women, doesn't look like the hyperactive stereotype. It looks like being spacey, disorganized, overwhelmed, which also looks like depression. So you get women spending years on antidepressants that help partially, but don't address the underlying attention disorder.
Is there any movement towards screening tools that can help with this in a time-efficient way?
There are validated screening instruments. The Adult ADHD Self-Report Scale, the ASRS, is a 6-question screener developed by the World Health Organization that's surprisingly good at flagging probable ADHD cases. For depression, you've got the PHQ-9, which is similarly brief. Using both together in primary care or initial psychiatric visits would catch a lot of the comorbidity that currently gets missed. But even when they are used, a positive screen on both doesn't tell you the direction of causality. It just tells you both dimensions are elevated, which you probably already knew from talking to the patient for 5 minutes.
Let me push on something you said earlier. The idea that you can treat the ADHD and the depression resolves because the depression was secondary to functional impairment. Is there a risk there of undertreating depression that's actually more independent than it looks? What if someone's mood improves on stimulants, not because their ADHD is treated, but because stimulants have acute mood elevating effects that are independent of their attention effects?
That's a really important concern. Stimulants, particularly amphetamine-based ones, produce euphoria in some people, especially at higher doses or early in treatment. That's not the same as treating depression. A patient might feel great for the first few weeks on Adderall and think their depression is cured, but what they're experiencing is partly the psychoactive effect of the medication, which may or may not be sustainable. Tolerance develops, the euphoria fades, and if there's an underlying depression that was masked rather than treated, it reemerges.
The temporal pattern matters even within treatment response.
Very much so. A genuine resolution of secondary depression driven by improved functioning tends to be gradual and sustained. It tracks with actual life improvements, better performance at work, repaired relationships, reduced chaos. The stimulant euphoria effect is more immediate and tends to fade over weeks to months. A clinician who's paying attention will distinguish between these. One who isn't might declare victory prematurely.
What about the reverse? Treating ADHD with stimulants in someone who's severely depressed? Is there a risk of making the depression worse? I'm thinking about the crash when stimulants wear off.
The calm-down effect is real and can be brutal in vulnerable individuals. As the medication wears off in the late afternoon or evening, dopamine levels drop, and some people experience a rebound of ADHD symptoms plus dysphoria, irritability, fatigue. If you're already depressed, that daily crash can deepen the sense of hopelessness. It's one reason that clinicians often prefer longer-acting formulations for patients with comorbid depression, smoother pharmacokinetics, less of a daily cliff.
If someone is on both a stimulant and an antidepressant, are there interactions to worry about?
Generally, the combination is well tolerated, but there are some specific concerns. Stimulants and serotonergic antidepressants both increase serotonin to some degree, and in rare cases, the combination can contribute to serotonin syndrome, though it's uncommon. More practically, stimulants can sometimes increase anxiety, and if the depression has a strong anxiety component, that can be counterproductive. There's also the fact that stimulants can interfere with sleep, and poor sleep worsens depression. So the prescribing clinician has to manage all of these interacting effects simultaneously.
It sounds like, pharmacologically, you're walking a tightrope where each medication potentially undermines the other's benefits.
Or they can be synergistic when managed well. There's actually some evidence that combining methylphenidate with an SSRI can produce faster and more complete remission in patients with both conditions than either medication alone. The idea is that improving executive function helps the patient engage more effectively with the antidepressant treatment. They can actually remember to take their medication, show up to therapy, implement behavioral changes. The ADHD treatment becomes an enabler for the depression treatment.
The order of operations matters, but not in a simple, always treat X first way.
The clinical art is in the sequencing and the monitoring. Some clinicians prefer to stabilize the mood first, reasoning that depression impairs the patient's ability to report ADHD symptoms accurately and to tolerate stimulants. Others prefer to treat ADHD first, reasoning that the functional improvement will lift the mood and make everything else easier. The evidence doesn't strongly favor one approach over the other. It's individualized.
Which is the kind of answer that drives protocol-minded people crazy, but is probably honest.
It is honest. Psychiatry is not at the point where you can algorithm your way through complex comorbidity. The guidelines give you principles: assess thoroughly, treat the most impairing condition first, monitor closely, adjust based on response. But the execution depends on clinical judgment, patient preference, and practical factors like which medications are covered by insurance.
Let's talk about the therapy side of this. Because medication is only half the picture, and for depression particularly, psychotherapy has strong evidence. How does therapy fit into the ADHD depression tangle?
This is where things get interesting, because the presence of ADHD can actually modify which therapeutic approaches work. Cognitive behavioral therapy is well established for depression, but standard CBT relies heavily on the patient's ability to monitor their thoughts, complete homework assignments, and consistently apply cognitive restructuring techniques, all of which require executive function. If the patient has unmanaged ADHD, they may struggle to do the between-session work that CBT depends on and then feel like they're failing at therapy on top of everything else.
You need a version of CBT that doesn't assume the patient has functional executive skills.
And this exists. There are CBT protocols specifically adapted for ADHD that incorporate more structure, more frequent check-ins, more external scaffolding. Things like body doubling, where the therapist or a peer sits with the patient while they complete tasks, or breaking homework into absurdly small steps that don't overwhelm the executive system. For patients with both conditions, this adapted approach can be more effective than standard depression. Focus CBT because it doesn't set them up to fail at the therapy itself.
Explain that one.
It's deceptively simple. The idea is that having another person present, even virtually, while you're doing a task, improves focus and task completion in people with ADHD. The mechanism isn't fully understood, but it seems to involve social facilitation and external accountability. The other person doesn't have to help or even interact. They're just there. And it works. There's a whole industry of virtual body doubling services now.
It's the human equivalent of those weighted blankets that are supposed to calm anxiety. Non-specific presence that somehow does something.
That's actually not a bad comparison. Low-tech, empirically supported, mechanism unclear, but doesn't really matter if it works.
What about the other direction? Does treating depression with therapy improve ADHD symptoms?
Depression amplifies ADHD symptoms. When you're depressed, your executive function is worse than baseline. Treating the depression can reduce that amplification, bringing the ADHD symptoms back to their baseline severity. It doesn't cure the ADHD, but it can make it more manageable. And importantly, treating depression can improve the patient's motivation to engage with ADHD-specific strategies. Someone who's hopeless about ever getting better isn't going to diligently use a planner or set up organizational systems. Someone whose depression has lifted might.
There's a virtuous cycle possible where treating either condition makes treating the other easier.
That's the optimistic framing, and it's clinically real. The pessimistic framing is that there's also a vicious cycle where each condition worsens the other, and the patient gets stuck in a downward spiral that's hard to interrupt from either direction. Both cycles exist. The clinician's job is to find an entry point that breaks the vicious cycle and hopefully initiates a virtuous one.
Let's go back to something the prompt asked about specifically. The case where depression is secondary to ADHD. Can treating the ADHD make treating the depression unnecessary?
In some cases, yes. And this is one of the more clinically important insights in this area. There's a subset of patients, and the literature suggests it's not trivial. Maybe 15 to 25% of the comorbid population whose depression is almost entirely a consequence of living with untreated ADHD. The chronic underachievement, the social rejection, the academic and occupational failures, the constant sense of being broken or lazy. That accumulation of negative life experiences produces a depression that is reactive and secondary. When you treat the ADHD effectively, the patient starts functioning better. The negative feedback loop breaks, and the depression resolves without any direct antidepressant intervention.
How do you identify that subset prospectively, rather than just discovering it retrospectively when the depression lifts?
That's the million-dollar question. There are some clues. Patients whose depression onset clearly follows a period of functional decline due to ADHD symptoms. Patients who describe their depression in terms of frustration, shame, and demoralization rather than anhedonia and vegetative symptoms. Patients who can identify periods when their ADHD was better controlled during a structured school environment, for example, and their mood was correspondingly better. But none of these are definitive. The honest answer is that you often don't know until you try treating the ADHD and see what happens to the mood.
Which brings us back to treatment as diagnostic probe.
And that's not intellectually satisfying, but it's clinically practical. Start with ADHD treatment, monitor mood carefully, and if depression persists after functional improvement, add depression-specific treatment. The risk with the reverse sequence, treating depression first and waiting, is that if the depression is secondary to ADHD, the antidepressant may not work well, or may work partially, and the patient spends months or years in a partially treated state while the underlying ADHD continues to generate new reasons to be depressed.
Is there a risk that starting with ADHD treatment, which typically means stimulants, could worsen anxiety or cause insomnia that then makes the depression worse?
Yes. And that's why the monitoring piece is non-negotiable. If you start a stimulant and the patient's sleep deteriorates or their anxiety spikes, you need to catch that quickly and adjust. Sometimes that means switching to a non-stimulant ADHD medication like atomoxetine or guanfacine, which don't have the same side effect profile. Sometimes it means adding a sleep intervention or an anxiety-specific treatment. The key is not to set and forget. Titration and monitoring are everything.
That's Stratera, right? The non-stimulant option.
It's a norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor. It doesn't have the abuse potential of stimulants, which is relevant for some patients, and it provides more continuous coverage rather than the on-off cycle of stimulants. The downside is it takes longer to work, weeks rather than days, and it's generally less effective for the core attention symptoms than stimulants are. But for patients with comorbid depression and anxiety, it can be a useful option because it doesn't exacerbate those conditions the way stimulants sometimes do.
There's also bupropion, which sits in this interesting middle ground, an antidepressant that also has some evidence for ADHD.
Bupropion, or Wellbutrin, is fascinating in this context. It's primarily a dopamine and norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor, which puts it mechanistically closer to ADHD medications than to SSRIs. It's approved for depression and has off-label use for ADHD. The effect size for ADHD is smaller than for stimulants, but it's not nothing. For a patient with mild to moderate ADHD and comorbid depression, bupropion can sometimes address both conditions with a single medication, which is pharmacologically elegant.
That's the kind of phrase that makes insurance companies nervous.
Actually, bupropion is generic and cheap, so they're probably fine with it. It's the newer branded combinations that make them nervous.
Let's talk about a specific clinical scenario. A patient comes in, they're 28, they've been treated for depression for 5 years with partial response, multiple SSRIs, some improvement but still struggling. Nobody has ever assessed them for ADHD. What should happen next?
This is a tragically common scenario. The patient has treatment-resistant depression, but the resistance might be because the depression is being driven or maintained by untreated ADHD. A proper ADHD assessment at this point could be transformative. The clinical pearl here is that any patient with depression that hasn't responded adequately to multiple adequate trials of antidepressants should be screened for ADHD, among other things. Sleep disorders, thyroid, vitamin D, all the usual suspects, but ADHD should absolutely be on that list.
If the ADHD assessment comes back positive, what's the treatment sequence?
At that point, you have a choice. You can add an ADHD medication to the existing antidepressant, or you can switch to a medication like bupropion that targets both, or you can consider whether the antidepressant is even necessary once the ADHD is treated. The conservative approach is to add ADHD treatment and see what happens to the depression over the next several weeks to months. If the depression remits, you can then consider tapering the antidepressant and seeing if the remission holds. If it doesn't remit, you've at least addressed one major contributing factor and can then optimize the depression treatment with clearer diagnostic information.
The partial response to antidepressants was actually a clue that something else was going on.
And this is one of those things that seems obvious in retrospect, but gets missed all the time in clinical practice. If someone has depression and ADHD, treating only the depression is like bailing water out of a boat without patching the hole. You might make some progress, but you're fighting an ongoing leak.
That's a very Herman Poppleberry analogy.
I have others, but the point stands. The hole needs patching.
What about the other direction? Someone diagnosed with ADHD who's been on stimulants for years but still isn't functioning well, still feels miserable. Could that be undiagnosed depression?
And this is the mirror image of the previous scenario. The patient and clinician may attribute all the functional impairment to ADHD, but there's a superimposed depression that's contributing independently. The clue here is often the presence of more classical depressive symptoms that aren't explained by ADHD. Anhedonia, the inability to experience pleasure, is a big one. ADHD doesn't typically cause anhedonia. It causes difficulty sustaining attention on pleasurable activities, but the capacity for pleasure is intact. If someone says, "Nothing feels good anymore, I don't enjoy things I used to love," that's depression, not ADHD.
Worth treating directly rather than assuming more stimulants will fix it.
More stimulants won't fix anhedonia. They might provide temporary mood elevation, but they don't address the core depressive pathology. That patient needs depression-specific treatment, whether that's an antidepressant, therapy, or both.
We've got four quadrants, essentially. Pure ADHD with secondary depression. Pure depression with secondary attention symptoms, both primary and independent, and neither primary but both present due to something else entirely like a sleep disorder or thyroid problem.
That's a useful framework. And the job of the clinician is to figure out which quadrant the patient is in, knowing that the boundaries are fuzzy and the patient might move between quadrants over time.
I want to ask about something that doesn't get talked about enough, the emotional component of ADHD itself. Because the DSM criteria are all about attention and hyperactivity and impulsivity. But a lot of people with ADHD describe emotional dysregulation as one of the most impairing aspects. Quick to anger, quick to frustration, mood swings that last hours, not weeks. How do you distinguish that from the emotional symptoms of depression?
This is a crucial distinction, and you're right that it's underrecognized. Emotional dysregulation in ADHD tends to be reactive, intense, and brief. Something happens. The person has a strong emotional reaction, and it burns out relatively quickly. They're over it in a few hours, maybe even minutes. Depression is characterized by more sustained, pervasive, low mood that lasts weeks and isn't necessarily tied to specific triggers. The ADHD emotional pattern looks more labile. The depression pattern looks more fixed.
Someone with both might have both patterns simultaneously. Reactive emotional spikes on top of a persistent low mood.
Yes, and that's actually a fairly characteristic presentation of the comorbid condition. The patient describes a baseline of low mood, anhedonia, hopelessness, the depressive core, plus episodic intensifications of distress in response to frustrations or failures that are often ADHD related. They forgot something important and now they're spiraling. But the spiral is on top of an already low baseline.
Which sounds absolutely exhausting.
And that exhaustion feeds back into both conditions. Fatigue worsens attention and worsens mood. It's another vicious cycle.
What's the role of lifestyle interventions in all of this? Exercise, diet, all the things that get mentioned as adjunctive treatments for both conditions individually.
Exercise is one of the most robustly supported interventions for both ADHD and depression. And it's woefully underutilized in treatment plans. The effect sizes for aerobic exercise on mood are comparable to antidepressants for mild to moderate depression. For ADHD, exercise acutely improves dopamine and norepinephrine signaling, essentially doing temporarily what stimulants do pharmacologically. The problem, of course, is that both conditions impair the executive function and motivation needed to initiate and maintain an exercise routine.
You're back to needing external scaffolding to implement the intervention that's supposed to help you build internal scaffolding.
This is where behavioral activation, which is a component of CBT for depression, can be helpful. The idea is to schedule activities regardless of motivation, to break the inertia through structure rather than waiting for motivation to appear. But again, ADHD makes scheduling and following through on schedules harder. So you need a level of external accountability that goes beyond what's typically offered.
It sounds like the most effective treatment for combined ADHD and depression might be having a very persistent personal assistant.
Unironically, external structure is one of the most effective interventions for ADHD, whether that comes from a coach, a therapist, a supportive partner, an app, or some combination. The ADHD brain is bad at generating its own structure, so you import structure from the environment. For depression, behavioral activation serves a similar function. You import activity scheduling because the depressed brain won't generate its own initiative.
Both conditions share a treatment principle, even though they're different conditions. Externalize what the brain can't generate internally.
That's a really elegant synthesis, and it explains why the combination is so challenging. You're trying to externalize structure for someone who may not have the motivation to use the structure you're providing. The depression says, "Why bother?" And the ADHD says, "I'll do it later." Between those two voices, nothing happens.
The therapeutic alliance must be doing a lot of heavy lifting here. The relationship with the clinician as a source of accountability and hope.
The therapeutic alliance is probably the single most important non-specific factor in treating this combination. The patient needs to trust that the clinician understands both conditions, isn't dismissing either one, and is willing to work iteratively. If the patient feels like the clinician is only interested in one diagnosis, or is just throwing medications at the problem without understanding the lived experience, engagement drops and outcomes worsen. This is true across psychiatry, but it's especially true for complex comorbidity, where the treatment path isn't straightforward.
Let's circle back to the original question about signs clinicians use to differentiate. We've covered temporal patterns, quality of attention complaints, mood architecture, treatment response. Is there anything else in the clinical toolkit? Anything more objective?
There's some emerging work on biomarkers, but nothing that's clinically actionable yet. EEG patterns, specifically the theta to beta ratio, have been explored as a potential ADHD biomarker, but the sensitivity and specificity aren't good enough for individual diagnosis. Neural imaging shows differences in prefrontal and striatal volumes and connectivity in ADHD versus depression, but again, group-level findings that don't translate to individual clinical decisions. For now, the differentiation remains clinical, based on careful history taking and longitudinal observation.
The state of the art is basically, ask good questions, listen carefully, and pay attention over time.
Which sounds low tech, but it's actually quite demanding. It requires time, training, and a willingness to tolerate diagnostic uncertainty, none of which are abundant in the current healthcare system.
That feels like a good place to land the clinical discussion. Before we wrap, any final thoughts on what a patient should do if they suspect they're in this diagnostic gray zone?
The most practical advice is to seek out a clinician who specializes in adult ADHD, not just general psychiatry. The training gap in adult ADHD is significant, and many general psychiatrists receive minimal education on adult presentations. A specialist is more likely to do the kind of thorough assessment we've been describing. And for patients, keeping a log of symptoms, mood, and functional impairment over time before the appointment can provide the kind of longitudinal data that makes differentiation easier. Patterns become visible in data that aren't visible in memory.
Self-tracking as a diagnostic aid. There's probably an app for that.
There are several, though the quality varies. But even a simple notebook with daily ratings of mood, focus, and productivity can be clinically useful. The act of tracking also helps the patient develop better insight into their own patterns, which is therapeutic in itself.
That's a thorough tour of a very tangled clinical problem. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1920s, a land registry ledger in British Honduras, now Belize, was discovered to contain a hidden section where the colonial surveyor had secretly mapped every mahogany tree worth more than 50 pounds on crown land, effectively turning the official property records into a private timber prospecting guide.
Colonial surveyors running a side hustle in the footnotes of empire.
100 years ahead of the insider trading curve.
The thing I keep thinking about after this conversation is, how much of psychiatric diagnosis still depends on the quality of the conversation between clinician and patient? We've got brain scans and genetic tests and rating scales, but when two conditions overlap this much, what actually differentiates them is a human being asking careful questions and another human being trying their best to answer honestly. That's both reassuring and terrifying.
It really is. The tools are getting better, slowly. But for now, and probably for a long time, the differential diagnosis between ADHD and depression is a clinical art supported by science, not a laboratory test. And that means access to clinicians who have the time and training to practice that art is the real limiting factor.
This has been my Weird Proms. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flemingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps other people find the show. We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.